You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the meeting grounds for spirituality and society, religion and culture.
In a Unitarian church, you only hear Jesus when someone spills coffee. What do you get when you cross a Unitarian with a Jehovah's Witness? Someone who knocks on your door for no particular reason. A Unitarian is really a Quaker with attention deficit disorder. You can tell it's a Unitarian service when people speak and say nothing, nobody listens, and then everyone disagrees. Heard about a Unitarian hell? It's a place where no one disagrees with us ever again. A woman went into a fabric store to buy material for a nightgown. She wanted 9 yards. 9 yards, said the clerk. Yes, 9 yards, said the woman. Isn't that a lot for a nightgown, asked the clerk. And she said, no, my husband's a Unitarian and he prefers the journey to the destination.
Keep saying it, keep going.
How can you tell a Unitarian? You can't tell them, they already know everything. And lastly, how many Unitarians does it take to change a light bulb? Get ready. We choose not to make a statement either in favour of or against the need for a light bulb. However, if on your journey you have found that light bulbs work for you, that's fine. You are invited to write a poem or compose a modern dance about your personal relationship with your light bulb. Present it next month at our annual light bulb sundry service, in which we explore a number of light bulb traditions, including incandescent, fluorescent, three-way, long life, and tinted, all of which are valid paths to luminescence.
I just knew when I saw in the roster, and I've had those jokes, and it's Hughes going to do the reading, oh, he'll kill them. He'll kill them. Can't you take a joke? I wanted to free up some time this week to catch up with pastoral calls, and to achieve a little extra time, I was going to revisit and rework an address from 3 years ago on laughter and religion, one which I flattered myself went down rather well then. It was a talk which used satirical jokes to mock other religions with variations on the light bulb joke. You know, how many Anglicans does it take to change a light bulb? How many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb? And then the talk turned the tables on us and mocked our tradition too, using the jokes Hugh has just read to you, to remind us of how silly our way of doing church can look too. If you want to look that talk up on the church website, it's called Gag Reflex. Get it? That was my plan, and they say if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. Because then the Charlie Hebdo attacks happened this week. And unless you've been living on Mars, you'd know that 12 French satirists working for that magazine were targeted and slaughtered in a terror attack by radical Islamists for repeatedly mocking the Prophet with what has to be said were pretty provocatively rude, obscene depictions that even we would have found offensive if we looked at them. I was going to have slides today, but, you know, why give that oxygen? So I really couldn't look at that old talk on laughter again in the same way. I couldn't repackage it to that fairly simple homily, which comes down to, if you're going to mock anyone or anything, maybe start with yourself first, or what you most cherish, and see how you feel about that before you do. There's too many Unitarian churches I've been in all over the world have misguidedly tried to build a better religion by mocking the bad ones, by jeering at how stupid and backward and evil other faiths can be, which, of course, gives dogmatic secularists yet another stick to beat up all religions while crying, "A plague on all your houses!" As if pure secularism was an unalloyed good. Such critical mockery, of course, sounds cleverer than it is. It is neither clever nor fair to turn a sharp, witty, critical eye on everyone else and forget to include yourself, the one who mocks, and therefore assumes it's above mockery. I also, to be honest with you, I also wanted to tell all those jokes myself, especially after last week's rather heavy talk about the cost and value of Mosaic leadership. And I wanted to do that in order to be better liked, to curry some cheap favor with you. But I saw in this week, and I see, a real danger for us in how we think about and respond faithfully to this event. So I felt I have a duty to you and to the wider movement by trying to formulate, as Bob put in the candles last week, some form of coherent Unitarian response to an event that has a lot to do with our heritage of standing up for free speech and free religion. Free speech and free religion, as we've seen, those two freedoms can make very uneasy bedfellows. So I read everything I could get my hands or thumbs on this week, from the broadest possible catchment of cultures, writers, disciplines, and political viewpoints, and I gradually came to the conclusion that there was no way a 15 to 20 minute talk like this one, no matter how rewritten and re-edited, could possibly compass all the religious, philosophical, cultural, and political issues this event raises for people, thoughtful people like you, my immediate audience, and my larger pastoral responsibility. Oh, yes, pastoral care comes from the pulpit, too. That's why this is called a service. No way a brief homily could unpick and problematize all the simplistic and patently false rot that's getting into our public discourse and move you on to what I think is a better perspective about it. Hell, an entire semester course could barely make sense of this event and the cultural fallout at this point in human history. So, at the beginning of the week, I got lost down various rabbit holes of, you know, the philosophical approach to free speech, Islamophobia, the psychopathology of terrorism, cultural and media bias, the history of French imperialism I even got lost in, the unseen forces of geopolitical power at play, and so on. So, the question of all contextual theology, where is God or the direction of the good in all this hot mess, became harder and harder to discern. This Friday morning, I had an hour-long talk that tried to say everything I could think of. What I'm reading to you now is not that talk, and represents a kind of surrender to that complexity, and also to accepting the duty to point to where I think the direction of the good is, the way a compass points to true magnetic north, without telling you what to think about that or where to go. So this is a surrender. I will not say everything that needs saying. I will not necessarily say what you'd like to hear. I can't and I won't try to relieve you of any difficult feelings you may have now or may develop by the end of this. Because in general, my Unitarian response is, je ne suis pas Charlie. I'm not Charlie. Let us begin with our own experience. Our own experience of being mocked. Did any of you take even a little mild offense at the jokes satirizing Unitarianism? Could you laugh at yourself to the extent you saw yourself in them? If you didn't take offense, it's not satire, it's humor. The whole point of satire is to expose BS and hypocrisy for what it is, and there are always going to be those who cherish their own versions of BS and hypocrisy, hence the offense. So offense inheres in the nature of satire. Satire intends to give offense. In fact, and not a lot of people know this, Parisians have a long satiric tradition called gouailler. These are anarchic, obscene depictions respecting nothing and no one. You know, think of naked bishops and that sort of thing. They're determined to cut down anything that would hold itself up as venerable or powerful or sacred. It's kind of like a tall poppy tradition of satire, but with pornographic and scatological tendencies. Charlie Hebdo was very much in that nothing is sacred French Parisian tradition. Charlie's satire is meant to offend. And while they've occasionally also brought other religions into the crosshairs, they've mainly intended to offend French Muslims. They succeeded. Let me ask you another question. Have you, or anything you cherish, ever been made fun of such that it hurt and was meant to hurt? Has that ever happened to you? You've been mocked so that it was meant to hurt. Invariably, when you object or simply blush, the rejoinder is, "What's the matter? Can't you take a joke?" And so insult is added to the injury. You're not just ridiculous, you're also humorless. Now, how do you feel and respond when you're personally mocked? Now, I would hazard a guess that most of us just inwardly seethe. Happily, only a very, very few are ever moved to physical violence. I wonder how many violent revenge fantasies are played out in the private cinemas of people's heads. Fantasies that would have the whole world jumping up and down and mourning and marching and sloganeering if they were acted upon. When I was a delicate, inward, and sensitive child, not like I am now, I was mocked and humiliated pretty routinely for it in school. As a young actor, I had some mocking reviews that actually made me cry. I said I'd be lying. I would be lying if I said that there were never any fantasies of violent retaliation in me. But in me was where those fantasies stayed. Why did such treatment not lead me to being holed up in a bell tower picking off my taunters with an easily available high-powered rifle? And that happens, you know. Humiliated, scapegoated people reach a tipping point and perhaps you, right now, taking a few moments, would like to turn to a person near you, maybe not the person you came with, but turn to a person near you and recount a time, each of you, when you are the butt of an offensive joke, how you felt about it and what you did. Go ahead now, take 2 minutes, I'll ring the bell. Thank you. Thank you. So now you've all, I hope, shared a time when you were the butt of an offensive joke and how you felt about it and what you did. Well, what's the matter? Can't you take a joke? So a direction of the good may be found in compassion for someone else who is mocked and belittled, knowing how you felt when it happened to you. The whole point of compassion, though, is not to restrict it to people who remind you of yourself. Point of compassion is to bridge that great metaphysical chasm between self and other, knowing that anything any one human being feels is oceanic. It touches all and reminds us of our deep interrelationship with all people. Where our love for each other is limited to those who remind us of us, it is at that frontier we are called, as people of faith, to love more abundantly. Where have I heard that phrase before? There is, of course, a big difference between a joke and a physical assault. Words do not actually kill or maim, and the actual killing or maiming can never be justified by emotional hurt, although try to tell that to a battered wife. No offense taken is ever an excuse for murder under any circumstances. To point out that Charlie Hebdo was intentionally, scurrilously provocative is not to condone the attack. And making that distinction points to another magnetic north where we Unitarians might find God or the good in this hot, bloody mess. Our cherished tradition of bringing reason to bear on our spiritual lives. Our tradition says, do not suspend your critical thinking just because you're having big feelings. Seek always to know more than you have been told by any authority. When we do this, we generally find we know a lot less than we think we do. Seeing more clearly can mean seeing less simplistically. An example of critical thinking and the challenging of authority here. Let me pose a few little thought problems. Don't answer these, but just sit with them for a moment. A few little thought problems that might show the how reason might be applied to this situation. Why was it that Anders Breivik, a contemporary neo-Nazi and self-professed 100% Christian, did not spark global outrage when he killed 77 of his fellow Norwegians, and there was no Je suis Norway movement to shout down such radical Christianity? Pause for thought. Here's another. What, in your view, is the difference in offense between the anti-Islamic cartoons of Charlie Hebdo and the evidently hilarious anti-Semitic cartoons of 1930s Germany? Should I show them to you today? Pause for thought. Given that, here's another, given that 2,000 Muslims, mostly the elderly, the infirm, and the very young, were massacred in Baga, Nigeria this week by Boko Haram, another radical Islamist group, why has the murder of 12 comedic Westerners completely eclipsed that far greater and more cruel human tragedy? Pause for thought. And finally, and this from the man for whom free speech is the freest because he owns a media empire, our friend Rupert said this week, and therefore echoed in all his news organs, maybe most Muslims are peaceful, but until they get rid of their radical element, they must all be held accountable. By that logic, all Catholics should be held accountable for pedophile priests, all Christians for the Ku Klux Klan and the Ulster freedom fighters. And all Westerners in general should be held accountable for drone strikes, imperialism, and Justin Bieber. Here's my question. Would you like to be held responsible for something you didn't do? Pretty sure Rupert wouldn't. Free speech is not a guarantee of true speech or good speech. Free speech works best when the populace is well educated and equipped with knowledge and thinking skills, to say nothing of compassion. Many are bandying around the world the quote attributed to Voltaire, "I disagree with what you say, but I defend to the death your right to say it." But we do not really mean that. There is no absolute right to free speech. You are not and should not be free to falsely yell fire in a crowded theater. You are not and should not be free to slander, libel, or defame, or racially vilify, or incite violence. Under Australian law, it's a major crime to use words to threaten to kill someone. If Charlie Hebdo is free to mock Islam, why is no one free to satirize the Jewish people or the State of Israel without bloody reprisals or high court injunctions? Can't they take a joke? Voltaire himself, by the way, never said those words. It's false. We were attributed to him, but he never said them. Voltaire was also, by the way, a rabid anti-Semite. How easily we are led by unexamined information and memes. Yes, us Unitarians too. Unitarians read scriptures and texts like this talk with admirable searching skepticism, poring over them for error and contradictions and hooey, like somebody with both Asperger's and obsessive compulsive disorder, yet seldom is that same critical eye turned upon media texts through which we get almost all our information about the outside world, the world outside our experience. We have swapped one dogma for another. That blind spot of ours, not to say subtle hypocrisy, always astounds me. The real tragedy of not bringing critical thinking to bear on the media we consume is that we lose our ability to appreciate and to navigate the true complexity and gray areas of life. We lose the larger view provided by history and cultural context. And we lose our ability, therefore, to imagine better solutions to our problems. If we just react to what we've been told, rather than stop and think and question and seek contextualizing data, how can we see more clearly? Where have I heard that phrase before? And if we do not ourselves strive to love more abundantly and see more clearly, how can we work toward a world better than the one we have? The better world we envision, the one that lives in our hearts and imaginings, what Christians used to call the kingdom. On the sheet in your order of service, on the back of the hymn, is a lyric I'd like you to look at. And I'm going to play this for you now. Stay in your seats. It's not a hymn. You baby boomers out there, sing along if you'd like. I'm going to. They sang that in the marches in Paris this week. If we jettison our heart and our mind and our hope for better, we deserve everything that's coming to us. If we want to build a better world, shall we eradicate all religion, all Islam, all radical Islam? Are you personally really up for that scale of slaughter and its unintended consequences, or are you just happy for other people's kids to do it for you? It is beyond question that radical Islam has, over the past 50 years, become a global magnet for disenfranchised, psychopathic youth, though not the only one. The English Defense League, the National Front, neo-Nazi groups in France and Germany, and the Ulster Freedom Fighters are others. Is there something inherent in the nature of Islam as a religion that is conducive to this magnetism? Many would like to think so, but alas, and I have to tell you that through extensive research, I tell you for sure there is no credible empirical evidence that religion or ideology are primary motivators for violent extremism. None. Violent extremism is not caused by a bad reading of a bad book. There are more injunctions to kill infidels in the Bible than there are in the Quran, and the Judeo-Christian tradition has a far longer, bloodier history of taking those injunctions seriously. Most people who think and write deeply about these issues agree. Radicalization is a social issue. So is it something in Islamic cultures that is conducive to attracting psychopaths? Well, a bit of historical context might help you here. A cursory reading of the history of the last 100 years, and you'd have to be willingly, willfully blind not to recognize that the West's relationship to the Islamic world, since it was carved up in World War I, has been a history of colonialism, imperialism, occupation, subjugation, and war. All of that ramping up in recent years with the violence and destruction raining down on that part of the world with a ferocity that has few parallels in history. Iraq, Gaza, Afghanistan have been utterly shattered with hundreds of thousands of non-combatants, otherwise known as innocent bystanders, dead, even more maimed, even more displaced, not 12. Hundreds of thousands of human beings who were in the wrong place at the wrong time, not unlike certain hapless cartoonists. All with stories, all of them with lives, all of them with families. France, in particular, has a particularly ugly colonial history in North Africa. So when Western values demand a rejection of violence and terror as political tools, I hope I'll be forgiven for having a big fat laugh at that. The cold fact is that the war on terror has killed in the past decade and a half 4,000 times more people than all the terrorism it has been trying to eradicate. It tries to cleanse, and it fails, and conversely produces through brutality, guess what? More psychopathy. Whatever social issues are the cause of radicalization, it's clear that they're not going to be disrupted by surveillance and force. Even Charlie Hebdo would agree, ideas are bulletproof. So can we rid the world of psychopaths? What produces group psychopathy anyway? I'm no psychologist, but one of the truest things I know is this. People who are hurt, hurt other people. Hurt people, hurt people. A more recent and focused example, those of you that remember the rise of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia in our lifetimes know that that crazed, secular, Marxist, ideological hellhole rose out of more than a decade of having US B-52s carpet bombing nearly every square kilometer of that nation. Result? A whole culture goes violently insane, and the pain and dysfunction ripple down the generations even to today. Can it be any statistical wonder then that when there are 1.4 billion Islamic people in the world, a very, very tiny percentage happen to be sick? And that these sick, subject to endless brutal provocation, are drawn to reenacting that violence, to enacting such malevolent reprisals as we've seen, returning brutality with brutality. Building a better world would certainly be one without so much psychopathy. Though we have about as much chance of eliminating psychopathic terrorism as we do eliminating psychopathic criminality. How can we reduce psychopathy in a culture? Here is a suggestion from nature. Have you, like me, rejoiced lately in the sweet summer rains that have come to us after all that heat? The sweet summer rains, you may also know, have released and produced a record number of mosquitoes. My neighbor has an above-ground pool that's caught much of the rain and larvae in its cover. And so I am plagued with mosquitoes. So much so that not even my weapons-grade bug zapper can deal with them all. It occurred to me that I have a few choices. I could shut myself indoors and hide. Or I could cover myself head to toe when I go out. Or I could be out there with a swatter trying to kill them all one at a time, and nothing would avail. Instead, it proved to be a better idea to drain the swamp my neighbor is cultivating so the little buggers can no longer breed in it. So it is with the psychopathy of terror. A wise physician tries to discern and treat the cause, not the symptoms. Do we just kill them all one at a time, creating more, or do we try to drain the swamps of injustice and oppression and brutal subjugation of this world that can drive fragile people to murderous, suicidal despair? Now, perhaps, you can see why social justice work is so central to religion and to church. A juster, fairer world will produce fewer psychopathic outbursts like this week. And it is up to us to work for it in how well-informed we are, how carefully we think, how much we cultivate and extend our compassion, and how we conduct ourselves toward all others, especially those who resemble us not at all. So, what do we as Unitarians do in the face of such events, in such a world as we are interdependent with? Well, I know what you don't do. You don't return hate for hate. You stop, you think, you seek to know more, you locate your compassionate heart, and you act from your values. The one value all religions share is this: do not unto others that which would be hateful if done to you. And so maybe this has been a long way of getting to a commonplace answer, and I see I've not saved much time, I'm sorry. But those sorts of answers have become commonplace because they contain timeless truth. The golden rule is more than an ethic. It is a theology. It is God as a verb rather than a noun. A verb we do. If God is what is meant by love, then where people like you and I embody and incarnate right relationship to each other, God is called into being. God is made present by us, in us, and through us. That is no joke. Sorry. Amen.
Rob McPherson's addresses are his intellectual property. They may only be used by other preachers. If his permission is sought and expressed, acknowledgement is given that they are his work, and the addresses are used in their entirety. To seek his permission, email Rob at unitariansa@bigpond.com.
That's our episode of Expanding Horizons for the week. The introduction is a piece named Elements by the artist CDK. The piece is licensed under Creative Commons. This is White Rabbit, out.